Hello, and welcome back to Better with Becky, a show for anyone on the journey to a stronger self and a better life. So how are you doing out there? No, really. How are you? As stated, I'm Becky Joy Searles, your host of the show, and I'm just happy to be here back at home after a whirlwind weekend girls trip. As my friend Katie put it yesterday when I checked in with her after our weekend away with some other women, she said, "What a whirlwind of awesomeness. I'm tired, but also delightfully rejuvenated from all the incredible female energy." But we'll get to all that soon enough. First up, I have a couple fun reviews from BWB listeners. Eat your heart out, Norway. And if you don't know what that reference is to, go back and listen to episode 2 from a couple weeks back on the kind of reversal of the 80-20 rule. I think you'll enjoy that listen. The first one is from my girl Ashley Mulhern, who I used to coach at my gym and who now uses my BWB app for lifting to support her fitness journey if and when it fits with her goals and her life. And she posted that second episode of the podcast and said, she quoted the part where I said, "Who you are right now, today, is your current reality, is who you are. The future isn't here yet and the past is over." And then added that she highly recommends my Instagram, Becky Joy, and the podcast, Better with Becky. Thanks, Ash. Great to hear that you are loving the podcast. And then from Adrian, who is a founding BWB member. By the way, when I say BWB, I'm referring to a couple things. My business name is Better with Becky, just like the podcast, but my first product is Build with Becky, which is a monthly strength training program that helps you learn how to progressively overload and get strong inside and out, and really helps you set yourself up for success with resistance training. So Adrienne was one of my founding Build with Becky members, and she's also a friend from way back in college who I got the privilege of studying abroad with in Honduras back in 2005. And her review says, "Practical. Always love Becky's practical suggestions and coaching. I've been doing the program for 2 years and love the application to real life and goal setting. Thanks, Becky." Thank you, Adrienne. In general, always love to get some feedback, but specifically, Adrienne is one that I always really take seriously because, one, we have such a history together on a personal level, but two, on a professional level, she's a physical therapist. So the fact that she finds the program to be safe, approachable, evidence-based, I think speaks volumes of the program. And just a reminder that you too can email me at podcast@betterwithbecky.com or, of course, leave a 5-star review so that more people can find the show. I do have some other 5-star reviews, but with no comment, which is an interesting choice. I understand that's quicker, but I would love to know your thoughts as well. So feel free to leave words as well as stars. So yeah, that's just a little pod mail. Sounds like the listenership is engaged and wanting more, which makes me very happy because I have a lot to say. Okay, so speaking of having a lot to say and kind of the topic today, I actually, as I was reading Adrian's review, was thinking back, oh, I guess I've kind of been this person for a long time, thinking of travel and intentional female friendship, even 20 years ago now, which is wild. When Adrienne and I were back in Honduras, we very much got to connect over travel and intentional cultivation of female friendship. But that's kind of what I want to talk about today, is reflecting particularly around intentionally cultivating friendships as an adult and the importance generally of social connection to our overall health and well-being. So I'll talk just a little bit about my own personal experiences with travel. My first time leaving the country was when I was 15 years old. My best friend at the time, her mom was from Mexico, so she was, you know, going to have her quinceanera, and she invited me to go along with her family, and her cousin also was turning 15, so it was this big double quinceanera, which is kind of like a sweet 16 in America, but a much bigger deal for Mexican culture, almost like a wedding with almost like wedding dresses and all of the dancing and celebrations and food and extended family. So I didn't really realize what I was getting into with that, but it was a very formative experience that really cemented my interest in learning Spanish and traveling generally. And also, of course, that was a female friendship and a very intentional one. And a lot of connection happened through that that would extend through the years. And we're actually still connected to this day. If you happen to listen, hey, Joanna, thanks for that first experience out of the country. After that, I also studied abroad, like I mentioned with Adrian, that was in college. So I lived with a Honduran family for a semester, and about 20 people from my university were there at the same time. And, you know, naturally different friendships emerged from that time. But that was an incredibly formative experience as well. While I was in Honduras, my husband Justin was in Japan and having a completely different experience. But I think the fact that we both had experiences abroad and really a lot of world-shifting experiences really set the tone for the rest of our lives together. And to this day is a big part of who we are. And then over the years, after those kind of initial big formative experiences, Justin and I have also traveled a lot together. And generally, I have traveled mostly with Justin or solo. So the biggest example of that is probably back in 2017. I took a sabbatical as I was a teacher and I was feeling a little burned out. I don't think I was quite ready to admit to myself that I was ultimately going to career change because it was just too big and scary. So I kind of put a little stopgap in and applied for a leave of absence. And my school district actually said, hey, if you can come up with a project that benefits yourself and the students, maybe we could do a sabbatical instead. And then you would have healthcare for the year, you'd get a stipend, and we would be able to save your position for you for when you come back. So I kind of thought about it and realized Justin was traveling a lot to speak at conferences, and I could kind of piggyback along with him. We could just pay for an extra flight, but there would already be hotels covered, and then I could potentially visit primary and secondary schools to learn about different education systems around the world and try to connect kids with kids from my school to kids abroad and have kind of digital pen pals to expand their global competence and awareness as well. So I did that year, and I actually got to visit 13 countries in 12 months, also a very broadening, shifting perspective. Even at the end of it, I wasn't quite sure what that would mean, but I knew that there was so much out there and that I could do almost anything. So I went back to school for a year, had the best year of teaching I'd ever had, and decided to kind of quit while I was ahead before the burnout returned. And that was the start of eventually moving to Japan to teach for a year. And then eventually COVID hit, and then the transition to personal training. But always for me, travel, and in particular, the friendships that I cultivate through travel, seem to always be a catalyst for some kind of shift or movement or intentionality in my life. This past weekend was no different. I got to go to New Mexico with a group of women, a couple of whom I knew before, two of whom I knew are BWV members as well. Hey, Abby. Hey, Katie. And one of them, they're both founding members, but Abby is an event planner and a very talented one. And she actually helped me plan my first Build with Becky retreat last year. And if I ever do retreats again in the future, I'm sure I will be working with her again because she's just excellent at what she does. And so I should not have been surprised at all that when she got this little inkling for bringing women together just for fun and seeing the alchemy that would happen when you combine dynamic female personalities in a shared space, I shouldn't have been surprised that it was going to be a little magical, but I was absolutely delighted to see that it was. One of the things that we got to do last weekend was a hot air balloon trip, and it was obviously perspective shifting, being up above in the sky in the clouds during sunrise in a beautiful hot air balloon. And interestingly, the man who was our pilot was ex-military, and he now has a hot air balloon that is ADA friendly, and he can take people up in wheelchairs, which of course tends to result in a lot of very special experiences, like maybe people who really want to do this as they're facing a terminal diagnosis or something of that sort. And the name of his company is Coddywomple, which is a word that I had never heard before but found incredibly delightful. So the definition of Coddywomple is to travel purposefully toward an as yet unknown destination. So I love the combination of traveling purposefully, like with intention, but kind of toward something you don't even know yet what it is. So kind of this idea of just keep going, even if you're not quite sure what it is. That's definitely defined my career change journey and probably my life, if I'm honest. I'm very intentional and purposeful with everything I do, but I also am very keen on just being in the moment and enjoying the journey, even if I don't really know what the destination is. So that kind of brings me to this spring. And in particular, I mentioned this weekend going to New Mexico, but really this spring has been a season of kind of opening up and trying new forms of travel. So instead of just traveling with Justin or just solo traveling, which I did quite a bit of on my sabbatical, I decided to say yes first to a trip with Abby to Colombia. And we went for 7 days in early February, and it was actually through a travel group, and there were 4 women total. And I wasn't really sure how I would feel about that, since I do tend to like solo wandering and being self-directed, but I was delighted and surprised that it was a wonderful time. And then that was followed up by this trip to New Mexico just for fun. And it was 8 of us women coming together. Of course, Abby knew all of us, but we didn't know each other necessarily. And then once we were all there together in New Mexico, doing a variety of structured and unstructured activities to just kind of allow that energy to come together and allow intentional female friendships to flourish and be cultivated. And while I could probably just talk about that weekend for this whole time, and I would love to do that, if we're in touch locally or if we do Marco Polo or chats, pick my brain all about it and I will talk about it till the cows come home. But to maybe tie it back to something a little bit relevant to health and well-being and all of that, I want to remind you of the study that I believe I mentioned at the end of the last episode about relationships. So this is a Harvard study, and it's one of the longest term studies. I think it's over 75 years and still continuing to this day, that kind of details the one secret to happiness. And after all the data that they collected as to what makes people the most happy, the quote that is kind of the takeaway I always hold from this study is that it was how satisfied they were in their relationships. So it said the people who were the most satisfied in their relationships at age 50 were the healthiest at age 80. I'm going to say that one more time. The people who were most satisfied in their relationships at age 50 were the healthiest at age 80. Now, there's a lot of things that you hear about longevity and living to a ripe old age. And, you know, there's the blue zones theory, which is sort of true and sort of discredited. They weren't sure if it was, you know, people in parts of Japan and Greece and other cultures living so long because of the food or because of the movement. But when it came down to it and they controlled for all these different variables, they realized the thing that older people have in common in these places, because the food differs, the movement and the culture around explicit exercise differs, but the one thing they all have in common is a really tight-knit social kind of cohort. So, for example, I know particularly in Japan and particularly in Okinawa, Japan, where people live often past the age of 100. And granted, some of this is also like the record keeping may have been flawed. So maybe they didn't live that long. And that's an issue too with the blue zones. But, you know, you go to Japan and you see a lot of very old people, and they are not only surviving, they are thriving. So I know that having lived there, there are an incredible number of activities, clubs, organizations, formally, but also just informally, the sense of kind of a core group of friends that check in on each other every single day. So obviously that's going to go a long way towards staving off loneliness. And getting into a little bit more of the topic of loneliness and relationships, Dr. Vivek H. Murthy, I hope I am pronouncing him right, he was our U.S. Surgeon General a few years ago. He actually published an advisory on the healing effects of social connection and community. And, you know, especially in the U.S., but even globally, there has really been a lot of research and a lot of evidence showing that loneliness is a lot more than just a bad feeling, and that it really harms both individual and societal health. It's actually associated with a greater risk of cardiovascular disease, dementia, stroke, depression, anxiety, and even premature death. So it's a little wild, but loneliness, the mortality impact, so kind of the risk to whether or not you survive or pass away, the risk of being socially disconnected, according to the evidence that we have, is similar to the risk caused by smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day. And it's even greater than the risk associated with obesity and physical inactivity. So, you know, here I am, a personal trainer who is very much wanting to promote movement and mindful eating and all of those aspects of health. And those do matter. We know those matter. I don't think anyone would say, hey, it's fine if you want to start smoking cigarettes and be overweight. Like, we know that that's not optimal, but I think we forget that even more important are things like the connections and relationships we have in our lives. That can be a little bit shocking when you look at the evidence. So not only, of course, mortality being a risk, but we feel those harmful consequences as a society in our schools, in our workplaces, in our organizations, anywhere where performance, productivity, and engagement are diminished. And there's kind of three vital components, the Surgeon General argues, of social connection. And they kind of center around the structure, the function, and the quality of our connections. So when it comes to the structure of our connections, that might be the number and variety of relationships that we have and the frequency that we interact with those people. When it comes to the function of our relationships, the degree to which we get our needs met through our relationships. So do we get the emotional support that we need, or maybe we're able to provide emotional support through mentorship or supporting others in a crisis? And going back to the structure of our relationships and the frequency, how many people do we have in our household, in our friend circle, marital status versus being single, that all kind of impacts your social connection. And then, of course, the quality of your relationships. So there are, as we know, there's relationship satisfaction, but there can also be relationship strain. There's these feelings of kind of inclusion or exclusion. So there's a lot of positive and negative aspects of relationships and interactions, all of which come together to impact how connected you are, for one thing, but then also what impact those connections really have on you. And it's kind of more of a continuum than it is a dichotomy. You know, we tend to think like, is this person lonely or not? But it's really more of a spectrum. So everyone falls somewhere on this continuum of social connection. And lower social connection is generally going to be associated with poorer outcomes and maybe more health issues, and higher social connection, conversely, will be associated with better outcomes. Now, I can definitely identify with that one because I'm a pretty outgoing person by nature, although I do kind of recharge solo. So I think I'm a bit of an ambivert, maybe actually an introvert who just kind of presents as an extrovert, if that makes sense. But I remember when we moved to Japan in 2019, even with my tendency to be a smiley, bubbly white lady, as my brother-in-law often says, you know, when I was anxious about moving there and doing my job well, he said, don't worry about it, Becky, just be a smiley, bubbly white lady. They're going to love you. And I think for the most part they did, but it didn't change that I felt quite isolated for a long time at the beginning, and then also at various points throughout the year. So even though I've traveled widely and gone all over the world previous to moving to Japan, living there was very different, for one thing. Living in a place is not traveling to a place, living and working in a place in particular. And I was in their school system, so it was not like just, you know, being an expat abroad. It was like trying to fit into a Japanese educator role as a foreigner who really can never do that. So that was very lonely and isolating. And then, of course, COVID hits halfway through. And now you're kind of the scary foreigner who, understandably, Japanese people fear might, you know, have the disease. And so for the first time, I'm experiencing things like people crossing the street when they see me and kind of trying to leave space around me. And granted, I come to find, and kind of still to this day, that people are doing that in America too, to each other. I don't know if you've ever gone on a walk and have somebody kind of step off the sidewalk to give you space as they walk by. That continues to this day in my neighborhood in Orlando. So I don't think it was at all personal, but of course, I'm there isolated from all of my support system and my friends. So I'm taking it personally and I'm feeling super lonely. And I actually had a 2-week bout of culture shock that was incredibly tough to get through and very paralyzing for those reasons. I think just the structure and frequency of my relationships was much smaller. My circle was much smaller. I wasn't getting all of my emotional needs met as a result. And I felt, when I was, you know, going through COVID, like it was kind of a crisis. And so there felt like there was a lot of strain in my relationships day to day, and it was very challenging. Another thing I think we don't think about a lot with relationships is that social connection is very dynamic. So our connections change over time. They might improve or be compromised for a lot of reasons, right? It could be illness or moving or a job change, countless other life events, or even changes to society politically, for example, with what's going on right now. So growing up, I did get a lot of experience with this aspect of social connection because I moved at least 8 times growing up. And then Justin and I met in Grand Rapids, Michigan in college, and then we moved to Columbus, Ohio, and we didn't really have a network of friends there. So for 12 years, we just were pretty heads down working, saving money, getting experience, and we had, you know, enough friends, and friends would visit us, but it was a pretty small social circle for us in Columbus. And then Japan was even smaller, as I talked about. And then when we moved back, at least we had the awareness that, hey, if we figured out life in Japan, we could probably figure it out anyway. So we moved to Orlando. And turns out Orlando is a place where almost everybody is a transplant. Almost nobody grew up here. So pretty much everybody's looking for friends here. And that really shifts the dynamic, which is really helpful. But throughout my life, just the dynamic nature of friendship has been at play. So I've had different friends and then had to move away from them, write letters. At one point, I had a friend that we would, I guess it was like the early days of Marco Polo, we would get cassette tapes and record our voices and mail cassette tapes back and forth to each other. So I have a lot of practice with keeping up with friends, moving, friendship shifting, losing touch, getting back in touch, that kind of thing. Of course, also when I left teaching, that whole circle of colleagues and kind of the friends that you work with shifted. When I left my gym, that shifted a little bit. The pandemic, of course, shifted things with moving to Florida. And then another thing to know about social connection, apart from it being dynamic and being kind of a continuum, you're not just lonely or not. It's kind of the spectrum that you fall in different places and you can move up or down the spectrum. It's also important to know that the absence of loneliness is not really enough to optimize our well-being. So similar to the fact that the absence of disease is not the same thing as good health, the absence of social deficits, so just not having loneliness, does not necessarily equate to high levels of social connectivity. So I kind of think of this one as, you know, let's strive to thrive, not just survive. So obviously you can get by, and especially if you are an introvert and you get your energy from solo time and downtime, you might be predisposed to not cultivate as many social connections. And on the one hand, that's completely fine. Everybody is different. Everybody has different needs. But on the other hand, we know from the research, particularly as we age, which I'll get into in a minute here, that social connections, and maybe not the quantity, but the quality of our relationships, is the number one aspect that not only gives us longevity, but also leads to happiness within that, what I call health span. So of course, longevity could be seen a couple of ways. You could just survive a very long time, like live to be 90 years old, but maybe the last 20 years of that, your body has broken down, you've had falling outs with friends and family, and you're just kind of alone and immobile, maybe even in pain or suffering or have an illness. And so the last 20 years of your life are pretty tough. I would call that longevity, and a long lifespan, but I would not say that's optimal or what I hope for. I hope for a long health span. That's a concept that Dr. Peter Attia coined, and it's essentially more so optimizing your life through movement, nutrition, but more so this kind of thing, relationships and cultivating connection, and all of these biopsychosocial, emotional, mental components put together, so that, let's say, now a person lives to be maybe the same length, 90 years, but that whole time they're able to get around, they're able to feel somewhat energized. Obviously, we're going to decline in older age to some extent, but at kind of a developmentally appropriate pace to where they are in life, they're able to get around, they're able to be energized, and they're able to stay connected to either their community, their family, or their friends, or ideally a combination of those. So maybe this person would be, you know, quite healthy until 80. They already got 10 more good years. And then maybe the last 10 years are just that kind of more gentle decline of course, we're all, you know, we're all dying from the moment we're born. And that's a fact that we don't like to face our mortality very much, but it's inevitable that none of us are getting out of this journey alive. So at some point we will decline, but it could be gentler and it could be more supported and it could be more joyful. So that's what I'm striving for, is more of a health span over a lifespan. Would I like my health span to be long? Of course. But even if it's shorter, I would rather have 70 good years and all 70 of them I feel able-bodied and connected, versus 90 years with 20 years at the end of pain and discomfort and loneliness. So it's something to really think about as we consider not just our fitness journey, but our really overall health and well-being. So on that note of maybe not just trying to survive, but really striving to thrive, let's look at some of our national trends for connection. And I'll post about these as well and link to them in the show notes. But it's pretty wild when you look at some of the visuals from the Surgeon General's advisory. He talks about the national trends for social connection. And from 2003 to 2020, we know that time spent alone increased while time spent on in-person and social engagement decreased. So when it comes to social isolation, there was an increase of 24 hours per month. And even within the household, social engagement of the family decreased 5 hours per month over that time. Even companionship, so even within a relationship, there was a decrease of 14 hours per month of social connection, let alone social engagement with friends dropped off even more heavily with a decrease of 20 hours per month. And then maybe like getting out of the house to engage with family, but socially, that decreased 6.5 hours per month. And then social engagement just with others, maybe not friends, but colleagues or something, also decreased 10 hours per month. So overall, just a huge decline in the amount of time we're spending alone at the same time as decreasing our impersonal, in-person social engagements. So that it's no surprise then that some of the key data they shared is that in 2018, only 16% of Americans reported that they felt very attached to their local community. I mean, sounds like it. If you're spending potentially 20 hours less per month with your own household, let alone your friends and family and just colleagues, you're going to feel more disconnected. And let's, in particular, the teacher side of me can't help but point this out for you parents out there. Let's talk about young people for a moment. So the rate of loneliness among young adults has actually increased every year between 1976 and 2019. And I have to think post-2020 as well. That must have continued. No surprise here, but social media is not helping. So in a US-based study, participants who reported using social media for more than 2 hours a day had about double the odds of reporting increased perceptions of social isolation compared with those who use social media for less than 30 minutes per day. This is definitely a big one, and I don't think it's just for kids. I think it's for everyone. And I think it's a pretty insidious, sneaky one, because what feels more connected than social media? I mean, it's social, and hopefully at least a large amount of the people you follow are people you know in real life. So it feels like you're kind of connecting with them when you see their posts, when you like their posts, but really, there's nothing passing of any real meaning between the two. So particularly the women I met this weekend, a few of them were really intentional about limiting their children's use of not just screens, but not allowing social media for their kids who are getting kind of into those tween years and really as late as possible. Both to just let them be kids for longer, but I think really to guard their mental, emotional, social health. And I think that's incredible if that's something that you're thinking of doing, but you're afraid that your kid's going to be, I don't know, the only one without it, or the one who really struggles socially because they don't have access to it. I would really rethink that and think about what a gift you could give your child by safeguarding their mental, emotional health. I actually read an article too. I'll see if I can track it down and put it in the show notes. But I read an article that interviewed some of those kids, like kids that did not have cell phones, that did not have social media. And while they did note that at times they felt a little bit out of the loop, for the most part, these kids were grateful to be out of the loop because they knew that their friends were wasting a lot of time, were getting into, you know, a lot of drama with their friends, a lot of fallouts. And they were just kind of like, it's not on the table for me. I get to go to school, focus, get my work done, play my sport, watch TV, hang out with my friends in real life. And I just don't know what's going on the apps, and I'm kind of grateful for it. So that was neat too, to hear from the kids themselves. They appreciated being allowed to opt out, if that makes any sense. So I think giving yourself permission to give them permission to opt out is something definitely to consider. So the existing evidence really does illustrate that we have reason to be concerned about the impact of some kinds of technology at the very least, and the use and how it impacts our relationships and our degree of social connection and therefore our health. In particular, when we're talking about children and adolescents, loneliness and social isolation among them increases the risk of depression and anxiety. And then what's really sad about that is that social isolation, which again is often brought on by use of social media or overuse at least, is arguably the strongest and most reliable predictor of suicidal ideation, attempts, and lethal suicide behavior among samples varying in age nationally and in clinical severity. So that's a huge thing. You know, like if there's one takeaway I have from reading that data and that research, it's that the kids are not all right and that they are kids. And so it's our responsibility as a society and as the adults in their lives to advocate for them and to protect them. Because imagine back in our childhood, imagine if we had access to these things. I find it difficult to navigate now sometimes as a 40-year-old woman. I don't know how I would have done it as a 14-year-old, but I know I would have struggled. And I think although I might have gotten a little snotty about it at times, it would have been a relief if it was on the table, if somebody had taken it off the table as something that I had to worry about. So that's just talking about the kids, but you know, it's not just the kids. Across all these different indicators of social connection, whether we're talking about the individual or relationships or the community or the broader society, there are so many different factors that can shape social connection. And the highest prevalence of loneliness and isolation is, of course, younger and older populations, but also it's prevalent for people in poor physical or mental health, because I imagine they feel more isolated, disabilities, financial insecurity, those who live alone, single parents, and then, like I said, younger and older populations. So we really do need to change across this full scope of the social ecological model as a society to help support people better. Because here's the thing. Here's some kind of scary data about connection. When we're talking all-cause mortality, so death by any reason, the data across 148 different studies with an average of a 7.5-year follow-up suggests that social connection increases the odds of survival by 50%. That is wild. 50%. Simply having social connections makes it so that you are more likely to stay alive by 50%. If there was a magic pill you could take that would cut your risk of death by 50%, everyone would be taking it. So social connection is huge. Then when we talk about chronic loneliness and dementia, so social isolation and chronic loneliness increase the risk of developing dementia by approximately 50% in older adults. And this is a really big issue in America and now globally, that the end of our lives, when I go back to talking about lifespan and health span, it's really shifted how we handle that phase of our lives. And we really don't talk about it enough. But for a number of reasons, you know, social reasons, cultural reasons, developmental, economic reasons, so many factors, people no longer really live with their children in old age, for the most part. Those numbers have really declined, and we're more so often living alone as we age, especially if we lose people that we were living with over time, whether due to disconnection socially or death of a partner, whatever it may be, divorce. Or maybe we're in a retirement community or a nursing home. But when it comes to those end of life years, we are really on our own. And the more we're on our own, the bigger the risk of developing dementia. And then when it comes to disease, a synthesis of data across 16 independent longitudinal studies showed that poor social relationships, so social isolation, poor social support, loneliness, were associated with a 29% increase in the risk of heart disease and a 32% increase in the risk of stroke. Plus, the opposite, including and involving support of family members, has been shown repeatedly to improve disease management and the health of people with type 1 and 2 diabetes. So really, all of this comes down to the usual, it's not just one thing when it comes to anything in your health and well-being. It's a multifactorial situation. So the influence of connection or anything on our health is always biopsychosocial, mental, emotional. So when we think about adults across the global rate and their relationships, When they talk about what's the most important source of meaning, purpose, and motivation in their life, it's no surprise that they talk about their familial relationships and their close friends. That is the number one source of meaning, purpose, and motivation for most people. And that's important because a sense of meaning is positively contributing to health because it motivates greater self-regulation in pursuing our goals, including our health goals. And I can identify with this even on the other end of travel. For example, when Justin is traveling and I'm home, I find it a lot harder to regulate myself and my behavior. You know, it just feels like, oh, it's only me. Why bother cooking? Or, you know, do I really need to wind down and get to sleep at a normal time? And so then like I'm snacking instead of eating a protein-rich meal, and then I'm staying up late instead of getting to bed. And then I stayed up late, so my sleep is worse. And maybe I sleep in and my schedule's off. I don't get my morning sun and walk, so my movement's down. And it's just this very downwardy spiral very quickly, because I just don't have another person in my ecosystem to help me even self-regulate, let alone co-regulate. So is that, by the way, I'm trying to think, codependent is something people like to ask about. And like, yes and no. Is that a problem? Yes and no. It's not great to be super dependent on a partner, but at the same time, then we get into kind of attachment theory and healthy attachment. And, you know, there is data showing that those with a life partner, particularly if it's a high quality relationship, do have a better chance at long-term health span and a higher quality of life. So there's, you know, pros and cons to everything and trade-offs to everything. But I'm just saying, I find on a personal level that self-regulation is harder when I'm on my own. So that goes back to those populations that struggle more with social connection. If you are somebody who is in poor physical or mental health, or you have a physical or mental disability, or some financial insecurity, if you live alone, if you're a single parent, or if you're younger or older, it is absolutely normal to be feeling a little bit disconnected and a little bit lonely. So just know that if that's the case for you, you are very much not alone. And that all of those kind of scary pieces of data, they're kind of, you know, ooh, let's note that red flag, but then let's maybe also think about what we can do with that. So that kind of brings me to our mindful moment. So let's go back to kind of where I started when I asked, how are you doing? And I want you to really pause and think about that after everything I just shared. And one mindfulness strategy that's also a good way to kind of get back in your body if your mind starts running in circles is to just put a hand on your chest and then maybe even put the other hand over that hand. And what that does is stimulate the vagus nerve, which helps you get out of kind of fight or flight and into rest and digest mode. So you're getting out of a sympathetic run away from a tiger and being threatened mode into a parasympathetic rest safety mode. So you might want to do that as we come to this conclusion. I'm just going to ask you again, maybe your hands are on your heart. Maybe take a breath in the nose and out the mouth. How are you doing? Really? How are you really feeling? From a biopsychosocial, mental, emotional standpoint, how is your body feeling? Psychologically, are you feeling resilient and able to tackle the challenges that are coming your way? Socially, like we talked about today, do you feel like you have people in your life that you could turn to with a true need or challenge, a mental or emotional need, or even just for fun? And if you acknowledge to yourself that it does feel like there's room for growth when it comes to your social connections and therefore your overall health and well-being, that is good. I think most of us could optimize a little bit in that area, especially if the Surgeon General's report is any indication, which I will link to in the show notes. Because remember, you're not alone with that. So let's make it a little practical. If you want more friends or connection, at least in your life, I would truly recommend that to make a friend, you be a friend. And I know that sounds simple, but one mantra that I have for myself that I return to whenever I feel a little less connected is that I create my community wherever I go. I'm going to say that again. I create my own community wherever I go. So I remember a couple years ago when I was getting into personal training, when I was starting at my gym, when I was so intimidated to be a beginner again and start over in a whole new field. And I had to be a baby giraffe, which if you don't know what that means, go back to episode one. I had to let myself be a baby giraffe and I had to wobble around and it had to be awkward and it had to be uncomfortable. And so I would cling to that mantra and acknowledge that it was true. I create my community wherever I go. And I am an active participant in that. I don't have to just let whatever happens, happens and be vaguely dissatisfied with my relationships. I can cultivate intentionally meaningful friendships and relationships in my life. So I recommend you do the same. Cultivate and practice consistent connection. Maybe you want to bump up to a higher fidelity form of communication when possible. As a concrete example, let's say you're on social media and you see a friend's post. What if instead of just liking it, you reached out and texted them about it instead? I think that the texts of today are kind of like the letters and packages of yesteryear. It's kind of like that you've got mail situation. You get very excited, especially when it's someone that you haven't heard from a while, somebody that you have history with. Everybody loves to know that they've been thought of. And then what if you went further? What if you had a little exchange back and forth and you made plans to meet up with that person, to catch up with them over a cup of coffee or personal trainer moment. What if you went for a walk instead of just sitting and consuming liquids or foods? That's something I love to do with my friends. And what if before you parted ways, you checked your calendar to see when the next meetup might happen? Honestly, making friends as an adult is a lot like dating. It's just we're out of practice for the most part. We forget that dating is inherently awkward and uncomfortable and that the first date might be pretty weird. The second one might be a little better. The third one, you're starting to be either like, for sure, this is not my person, or maybe. And by the fourth one, like you've just had enough frequency of interaction that you kind of have a new friend. So like give it a few tries, rinse and repeat, keep showing up and practice. Let yourself be awkward. Let it be what it is. Be a baby giraffe socially and just see what might happen. Be curious, not judgmental. Remember, you never have to do everything all at once when it comes to your health and well-being. And you don't have to do it alone, nor does the research suggest that you should. If you need help, support, or have questions or thoughts about any biopsychosocial, mental, emotional topic, or you're just looking for an intentional female friend in your corner, I would absolutely love to hear from you. Email me at Becky@betterwithbecky.com. Until next time, let's keep going on this journey to a stronger self and a better life.